Modern-day slavery is more common than you might think. While there's been recent media reports of worker exploitation and an increase in the number of cases being investigated by police, it's believed many instances of slavery remain hidden. Now, a parliamentary inquiry is investigating whether Australia should adopt laws to crack down on modern slavery. It's something the UK has already taken a lead on. The inquiry has heard that regional horticulture is ripe for exploitation of illegal migrant workers. Serena Locke spoke to one man who managed to escape slavery and now wants to go undercover to help flush out dodgy labour contractors.
Paul was lured to Cairns from Papua New Guinea with a promise of TAFE education and good work, but he was conned by a far north Queensland banana farmer.
I ended up living in a shed, working 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and driving tractors and eating bread and cordial for breakfast and for lunch with a dog.
You lived in the shed with a dog?
Yes.
What sort of pay were you getting for the 12-hour days?
No pay. The guy who brought me here, he says he's going to pay my school fees for TAFE. When I asked him for my pay, he said, keep a record of it every morning and every day. So I kept a record on a notebook. And then when I showed to him, he said, oh, keep it. I got his money for you. I will pay your school fees. He showed me this, showed me his hotel and his restaurants and all that, and said, I'll get you, after you finish your studies, I'll get you a job and you'll stay in Australia. So he said, all the money I'm putting aside for your school fees.
After 3 months, Paul found others who were also working on the farm, many for much longer.
There was another Fijian Indian man, on the other side of the farm. The other manager is an Indian man, and then he normally comes in and say, oh, Paul, you don't go on that side of the farm. This morning, you go this side. So he was trying to separate me and the other Fijian man. A Fijian man was on the same boat as me. They've been treating exactly the same thing for 7.5 years. They promised him to bring his family to Australia, but they never brought it. So that's how I decided to escape.
In June last year, the banana farmer Sona Singh Bella of Cairns was jailed for 3.5 years for a visa scam involving over 40 migrants from India. But Paul's troubles were not over. He landed in Mildura, Western Victoria, to work for a labour hire contractor on a dozen farms in the district. Living in squalid, cramped conditions, he was paid in cash.
I was left with only $60 to $70. The contractors, they use, say, oh, you're going to pay for the fuel, drop up and drop pick up, and then the food, the rent, bill, he gets all of them, and then we are just left with $60 or $70.
Which is probably a tenth or less than a tenth of what you should have been earning, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Paul says he left PNG because of the violence there, but he says the fear was worse in Australia because the contractor would use coercion to keep the workforce at Mildura.
Because they threatened us too, these contractors here said, oh, the cops are going to come. If you want to go back to PNG, you better go and show up on the road. Otherwise, you just keep quiet, stay inside and yeah.
And why were you so vulnerable? Why did that frighten you?
Well, I don't want to go back to PNG. We shift from, sometimes we even jump in the car and drive around from 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning till 7 or 8 a.m. in the morning and then we go to work.
What's happened since to that labour hire contractor that you worked with around Mildura?
Still there.
One day, Paul had enough and tried to find a course to study. That was the beginning of his second escape.
Went to a library and said, I want to do some studies. I don't want to live like this. Oh, how can I do it? And then they asked me, oh, you got to have work rights and study rights. And I said, why? I can work and I can study, I said. And I said, no, you have to have the rights.
And is that the point that you found the Community Legal Aid Centre JobWatch?
That's right.
JobWatch is run by Zana, by the way. Zana, how would you describe Paul's case?
JobWatch has many examples of Paul's scenario where people basically are exploited, they're coerced to work in appalling conditions. Any requests for payment or any requests for better conditions can result, of course, in threats of violence. And for most people, the most significant aspect is deportation, because that's what they fear most, because notwithstanding the horrendous conditions, the fear of deportation often is a very, very big stick. So that's what they want to avoid.
Zana, by the way, at JobWatch Legal Aid, says they were able to recover Paul's entitlements and are now helping gain him a protection visa.
Paul, what do you hope to do in Australia?
I wish I pinpoint these people. They are not treating the people. The human beings. Australia should treat them. These one or two people who are treating like.
So you would like to be part of the investigating teams?
Yes.
Do you think you would like to work in that area?
I really would like to do. And as I said, you will not catch those people if you just dress up in a suit and if you say I'm coming to get a report and if you walk into the farm. So if you know, you will not catch. That's how you won't catch these people. If you go in there as a normal people, if you work with them, live with them, you will definitely find what's inside. But because the workers are inside a banana garden or the orange farm or wherever it is, and they're working very quietly, and only the big people will come and talk about it, but you will never know. But unless you go inside there and you work with them, you will exactly see what's going on. And I want to do that.
Zana, by the way, at JobWatch Legal Aid, says Australia should adopt a modern slavery act to give the authorities inspection and criminal investigation powers.
We would like in Australia to establish an independent and anti-slavery statutory agency such as a commission, and to give that commission the powers to investigate and to enforce and to be able to act on individual cases and in certain respects request the police to act. And I also think it would be very useful, a great opportunity to give individual standing to community legal centres such as JobWatch, whereby we can represent people. These people are often fearful, they have no way of navigating their way through a very complex area of the law. And I think that Paul's example, where JobWatch was able to hold his hand and take him through the process, is a very important example, because without that, a lot of people won't take the step forward. So we'd also like to see that introduced as well. We'd also like, within this Modern Slavery Act, if we were to adopt one ourselves, provisions where the Commission can name and shame in Parliament in the way that, for example, the Australian Human Rights Commission can. So that's very important. And also we'd like to have provision within the Act that the Commission can educate and create community awareness about modern slavery laws, because one of the greatest barriers that we face is that these people put up with these conditions because they seriously think that that is the way it is and that there is nothing that they can do about it. But if we tell them otherwise, if they become aware of it, then I think that we will the preventative aspect will be really significant.
Zainab, by the way, head of the legal aid service JobWatch, and we also heard from exploited worker Paul in that report by Serena Locke. Experts are tipping this summer is likely to be a bad one for bushfires. And there's a good chance as fires break out across the country, more women will be involved in putting them out. Female firefighters are increasingly taking on frontline roles that were once the preserve of men. It's meant fire services have had to consider things like childcare and breastfeeding breaks during training sessions as they seek to recruit and retain more women volunteers. One of those volunteers is Stephanie Louie, a member of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service's Remote Area Firefighting Team. It's a group of specially trained firefighters who winch out of helicopters to fight blazes in tricky terrain.
I always say it's really easy to winch. It's a really easy set of steps. You just have to get them 100% right 100% of the time. But there is anxiety, I suppose, because, you know, you've been flying in a helicopter for, say, 30 or 40 minutes. It's not a beautiful you know, 18-degree day, it's probably 40 degrees. You're feeling slightly sick because you're crammed into the back with, you know, another couple of sweaty people. And then you get there and it's hot and it's windy and you're looking at this fire trying to decide what you can do about it and if you can do anything about it. There's a lot going through your mind. When you get on the skids, it's really loud, I suppose, because, you know, the rotor blades are thumping and you've got that whine of the engines. You can feel it in your chest.
While she's comfortable doing it now, Stephanie wasn't sure she was ready for joining the elite firefighting unit.
I'd sort of always said, oh, when I've got a bit more experience, or maybe when I'm a bit fitter, or maybe when I'm a bit stronger, I'll go and try and join the team. And I was having a conversation with one of the very senior volunteers in our district who was very involved with the team, and I was saying, oh yeah, you know, one day I'd like to go and join this and do this because I think it'd be really good. And he just said to me, Stephanie, I think you should try that now. Why don't you just go and do it? So I did, and it's been amazing.
Were there many other women in that part of the service when you joined up?
We're still quite low numbers, so we're pegging at around 10% females in remote area firefighting. It's possibly not quite as many as would be nice, but we're working on that.
Why do you think there are lower numbers of females in that area? What might be the reason why there hasn't been females in that area?
I think there's several reasons for that. The first is that a lot of remote area firefighting, because it's remote, is what we call extended deployment. It's not just a matter of jumping on the truck and being home in a couple of hours, which is much easier to fit in with family life. You're talking about, you know, full day deployments. You're often talking about multiple day deployments. And for women, you know, often you're the primary caregiver, and being away if you've got a young family is quite tough. On top of that, we've got prerequisites to join the remote area program. You see an attrition from sort of lower ranks to higher ranks throughout all of the emergency services, and the RFS is certainly no different to that. And so the absolute numbers, I suppose, of women that actually have the prerequisites is also can be quite low. So I think there are multiple factors there.
Has there been a bit of a push to try and get more women as volunteers generally, but particularly in this area?
Absolutely. There's been a big push to improve the numbers of women throughout the RFS and indeed in most emergency services.
Why is that?
There are a few reasons. The first one is simply that we are an emergency service. I think it's important that your emergency service reflects the community that you serve. So because you are an emergency service, you generally see people on days which are not their best days. You know, often you're seeing people on the worst day of their lives. So if you can be like that person, if you are like that person, it's much more reassuring for people that it's going to get better and that it will be okay. And that's diversity in general, not just women, but also, you know, if you can speak to a person in their own language and things like that, it's much better in an emergency situation. I think the second thing is really about the firefighting in general. So in firefighting, we have something called situational awareness. And that's the idea that a fire's really not that safe a place to be. So you can't just say, well, there's a really dangerous thing over there, it's called a fire, now no one go near that and everyone will be safe, because that doesn't get the fire out. So situational awareness is really around the idea that you can be safe by having a look at what's going on around you and processing that, and then making projections or making predictions about what's going to happen. And that's what keeps you safe. The thing with that, though, is that the way we make decisions in life is based on our experiences. So it's about what you've done in the past, what you've seen in the past. And so if you have all the same type of person, then you're generally all looking for the same thing, and then things get missed. Whereas if you have a whole group of people that are really diverse and they've got really different backgrounds and they've all seen different things and experienced different things, then you're more likely to have good decision making. You've got lots and lots of people looking out for different things, so things are much less likely to fall through the cracks. And the last reason is actually really easy. We're a volunteer service, and everyone's busy, right? You know, our lives are getting busier, our mortgages are getting bigger, and everyone's got less time. So if you're only recruiting out of 50% of the population, everyone's got to do more work. If we can recruit out of 100% of the population and there are more volunteers, then all of a sudden everyone has to do less. It's to me, it's really a no-brainer.
How have the RFS been successful in increasing their number of women? What are some of the things they've done to try and attract more women and, I guess, retain and kind of inspire and promote the women that they have, like yourself?
So in remote area firefighting, which is really the area that I'm most familiar with, we've done a few things. The first is just trying to make training a little bit more family friendly. You know, going away to fires will always have an impact on family. You know, you can't get away from the fact that, you know, if you have to be away because there's a big fire, you can't really get away from that. But most of what you do in a fire services training. So what we tried to do was make it just a little bit more family friendly. So that might be bringing your child because your babysitting's fallen through and having them, you know, supervised up the back of the classroom as you do your course. It might be something as simple as being able to go home at night on a residential course, or things like coordinating breastfeeding breaks for women that are coming back to the service. So one of the women that I talked to had done her remote area course and then had actually gotten pregnant and had a baby before she'd gone and had time to do the assessment. So when she was ready to do her assessment, her baby was about 4 months old, so was still being breastfed quite a lot. She organised that her mum came along to her assessment, and we just timed it so that her mum could bring her baby into the field at several times during the day to be breastfed. And that let her complete her assessment. We're really talking quite small changes. The other things that we did was we actually did a review of our learning materials. So we realised that every picture was of men. I know that sounds really, really small, but when you don't see people like you in your learning materials, it becomes quite hard to imagine yourself actually doing it. Being able to see yourself represented there means that you're more likely to say, actually, maybe I can do this because there are people like me that already do it. We retook some of the photos and we replaced some of our diagrams, so it just showed a diversity of people. The final thing that we did was we had a look at our instructor team. So since 2014, we've had 75% of our courses have had one female, at least one female instructor or assessor. I guess a lot of the studies out there talk a lot about you need strong role models throughout your training process to help women along. By having women there, it was actually quite interesting because it was actually the first time a lot of our trainees had actually had a female instructor. So some of them had, throughout their years of service, had never actually had a female instructor.
Stephanie encourages other women thinking about joining the firefighting service to give it a go.
You know, you are strong enough, you are fit enough, you are tall enough, just go and try it. There's a role for everyone, and we definitely need more women throughout the service, and there's so many different roles that you can find something that works for you. You'll end up doing things that you never thought you would. You know, I joined the service to meet some people and now I'm, you know, winching out of a helicopter. It's that it gives you so much room to grow and try new things and also serve your community. It's sort of the perfect volunteer role.
Stephanie Louie, a volunteer with the New South Wales Rural Fire Service and also a mum to a little baby girl who you may have heard in the background in that interview.